He appeared bright, he appeared rather larger than the others, and when I looked at the sacred figure I found that I, too, was a bit larger than was my normal state. Again, a great knot of fear seemed to be inside me and my stomach churned with fright. But the Lama took my elbow, reassuring me with, "It is all right, Lobsang, there is nothing for you to fear. Come with me." He led the way with his hand on my right elbow. Carefully we skirted the Lamas still sitting in a circle. I looked, and I looked in the center of the circle, but my body was not there, there was nothing there. Carefully I felt myself, and I felt solid. Surreptitiously I reached out and touched the Lama beside me, and he was solid too. He saw my gesture and laughed and laughed. "Lobsang. Lobsang. You are now in a different state complete with your body. Only those with the greatest occult ability, inborn ability, can do such a thing as that. But come with me." We walked on to the side of the temple, and the wall came closer and closer. I withdrew from his grasp and tried to turn aside, exclaiming, "No. We shall hurt ourselves unless we stop. This wall is solid." The Lama regained his grip on me, and commanded, "Come along. When you have more experience you will discover how simple this is." He moved behind me and put his hands between my shoulder blades. The wall loomed ahead, a solid wall of gray stone. He pushed, and truly the most remarkable sensation of my life came upon me as I entered the stone of the wall. It seemed as if my whole body was tingling, it seemed as if millions, billions, of bubbles are bouncing against me, not impeding me, just tickling me, just making my hair stand on end, just making me itch pleasantly. I seemed to be moving without any difficulty whatever, and as I looked I had the impression that I was moving through a dust storm, but the dust was not hurting me, it was not troubling my eyes at all, and I put out my hands and I tried to grasp some of the dust. But it went through me or I went through it, I do not know which is correct. The Lama behind me chuckled and pushed a little harder, and I broke right through the wall and into the corridor beyond. An old man was coming down, carrying a butter lamp in each hand, and carrying something pressed between his left elbow and his body. I tried to avoid contact with him, but it was too late. Immediately I was set to apologize for my clumsiness, but the old man went on. He had walked through me, or I had walked through him, and neither of us was aware of the contact, neither had the slightest impression that we had just walked through another human. With the Lama guiding me, we moved through the building, never intruding upon the privacy of others alone in their rooms, but instead visiting storerooms and, a rather caustic comment or gesture on the part of the Lama who knew me so well, we visited the kitchen. The old cook monk was there resting against a great leather container of barley. He was scratching at himself and picking at his teeth with a piece of stalk from somewhere. Every so often he would turn and spit in the corner, and then get back to his scratching and his tooth picking. Eventually, as we stood watching him, he turned around, gave a hearty sigh, and said, I, time again to prepare food, I suppose. Oh, what a life this is, Tsampa, Tsampa, and yet more Tsampa, and all these hungry people to fill." We moved on and on through the building. My legs did not trouble me at all, in fact, to be truthful about it, I did not even think about my legs, for there was no reason that I should, they did not disturb me. We were careful, very careful, not to invade the privacy of another person. We turned the corridors as much as we could so as not to enter any individual living space. We came, deep down, into the storerooms. Outside there was my old friend, Honorable Puss Puss, lying stretched out full length on his side, twitching slightly. His whiskers were quivering and his ears were flat upon his head. We were approaching soundlessly, we thought, but suddenly he awoke to full alertness and sprang to his feet bristling and with bared fangs. But then his eyes went crossed as he looked at the astral plane, as all cats can, and he started to purr as he recognized me. I tried to pat him, but of course my hand went right through him, a most remarkable experience, for I often patted old Honorable Puss Puss and never before had my hand gone inside. He seemed as amused as I was distressed, but he just gave a butt at me, which went through me to his surprise this time, and then he dismissed the whole thing from his mind, lay down, and went to sleep again. For a long time we wandered through solid walls, rising up through floors, and then at last the lama said, "Down again, let us go down, for we have journeyed far enough on this occasion." He took my arm, and we sank down through a floor, appearing from the ceiling beneath, and through another floor, until we came to the corridor off which the temple lay. Once again we approached the wall, but this time I had no hesitation. I walked through it, rather reveling in the strange sensation of all those bubbles coming, all that pleasant tickling. Inside, the lamas were still in their circle, and my lama, the one who was holding my arm, told me that I should lie down in the position I originally occupied. I did so, and on the instant sleep came upon me. Chapter 8. Somewhere a bell was tolling, muted at first by distance, it rapidly grew in volume. Clang! Clang! It went. Strange, I thought, a bell? Good gracious, it is tolling in time with my heartbeat. For a moment panic threatened to overwhelm me. Had I overslept and been late for temple service? Blearily I opened my eyes and tried to see where I was. This was strange. I could not focus. All I could discern was 9 horrible white blobs stuck on the top of saffron streaks. My brain creaked with the effort of thought. Where was I? What happened? Had I fallen off a roof or something? Drearily I became aware that there were various aches and pains surging back into my consciousness. Ah, yes. It all came back with a rush, and with the knowledge came the ability to focus my eyes and see what was before me. I was lying on my back on the cold, cold stone floor. My bowl had somehow slipped from front to back in my robe and was now supporting my weight between my shoulder blades. My Bali bag, of hard leather, had worked down and was almost breaking my left ribs. Touchily I moved and stared up at the 9 lamas sitting watching me. They were the horrible white blobs stuck on saffron streaks. I hoped that they did not know what I had thought. "Yes, Lobsang, we do know," smiled one. "Your telepathic thoughts were very clear on the subject. But rise slowly. You have done well and fully justified your guide's remarks." Gingerly I sat up, receiving a hearty butt in the back and a roaring purr as I did so. The old cat came round to face me and touched my hand as a sign that he wanted his fur ruffled. Idly I did so as I collected my scattered wits and wondered what would happen next. "Well, Lobsang, that was a good experience of getting out of the body," said the lama who had accompanied me. "We must try it often so that you can get out of your body as easily as shrugging off your robe." "But, honorable lama," I said in some confusion, "I did not leave my body, I took it with me." The lama guide's jaw dropped in astonishment. "What do you mean?" he exclaimed. "You traveled in spirit with me, honorable lama," was my rejoinder. "I looked specially, and my body was not on the floor, so I must have taken it with me." The old, wizened lama, the smallest of the 9, smiled and said, "You are making a common mistake, Lobsang, for you are still bemused by the senses." I looked at him and quite honestly I did not know what he was talking about. It seemed to me that he had taken leave of his senses, for, I thought, surely I should know if I saw my own body or not. And if I did not see my body, then it must not have been there. I suppose they must have seen by my skeptical glance that I was not taking in what they were saying, what they were implying, because one of the other lamas motioned for me to pay attention. "I am going to give you my version of it, Lobsang," said this other lama, "and I want you to pay close attention, for what I have to say is elementary yet it is a matter which puzzles a lot of people. You were lying on the floor, and as this was your first conscious time of astral traveling, we helped ease your astral form out of your physical form, and because it was done by us who have a lifetime of experience, you did not feel any jolt, or any disturbance. Wherefore it is clear that you had no idea that you were out of the body." I looked at him, and thought about it. I thought, yes, that is right, I had no idea that I was out of the body, no. One had said that I was going to be out of the body, so if they hadn't told me what to expect, how could I have a feeling of leaving the body? But, then, It all came back to me that I had looked down and I had not seen my body lying on the floor as surely I should have done unless I was still in the body. I shook my head as if to shake the cobwebs loose. I felt that all this was getting too deep for me. I was out of the body, yet my body wasn't there, so if it wasn't there, where was it, and why hadn't I seen it lying about somewhere? Just then the old cat gave me another butt and started knitting, bumping up and down on my lap, sinking his claws into my robe, and purring louder and louder, reminding me that I must stay aware of his presence also. The llama who had been speaking laughed as he remarked, "The old cat is telling you to scrape your brains clear so that you may perceive." I spread my fingers and raked the cat's back. His burrs increased in volume, then suddenly he just flopped at length. He was a big old thing, his head was sticking over one side of my lap and his legs were protruding over the other side, with his tail stretched straight out on the floor. These cats grew larger than the average sort of cat. They were normally fierce, but our temple cats all seemed to recognize me as a brother or something, because certainly I was as popular with them as they were with me. The llama who had been speaking to me before turned to me saying, "Leave him be, he can rest on you while we talk to you. Perhaps he will give you a good dig every so often to remind you to pay attention. Now, people see what they expect to see. Often they do not see that which is most obvious. For instance," he looked hard at me as he said this, "how many cleaners were there in the corridors you came along? Who was that man sweeping in the barley store? And if the Lord Abbot had sent for you and asked you to tell him if you had seen anyone in the inner corridor, what would you have told him?" He paused for a moment to see if I was going to make any remark, and as I stared at him, open-mouthed, "I am afraid," he continued, "you would have said you saw no one in the inner corridor, because the person who was in the inner corridor was a person who has every right to be there, who is always there, and who would be so correct in that corridor that you would not even notice him. So, you would say you saw no one in that corridor." Another llama broke in, nodding his head wisely as he added his piece, "The proctors often have some difficulty when they are carrying out an investigation. They may ask if there were any strangers, or if anyone had been in a certain building, and invariably a custodian of the building would say that, no, no one had been in. And yet there might have been a procession of people, there would be proctors passing, there would be perhaps a llama or two, and there might even be a messenger from another llamasery. But because these people were so common, that is, because it was so usual for them to be in the vicinity, their passage would pass unnoticed, and as far as being observed, they might just as well be invisible." One who had not yet spoken nodded his head, "Yes, that is so. Now I ask you, Lobsang, how many times you have been in this temple? And yet by your look quite recently you had not even seen the stand upon which we rested the crystal. That stand has been here for about 200 years, it has not been out of this temple, and yet you looked at it as if you were seeing it for the first time. It was here before, but it was commonplace to you, therefore it was invisible." The llama who had been with me on my astral trip through the Potala smiled as he continued, "You, Lobsang, had no idea of what was happening. You did not know you were going to be out of the body, therefore, you were not prepared to see your body. Thus, when you looked at llamas sitting in a circle, and your attention carefully avoided your own body. We get the same thing in hypnotism. We can hypnotize a person to believe that he is completely alone in a room, and then that person in a state of hypnosis will look everywhere in a room except at the person who shares the room with him, and the hypnotized person, on being awakened, would take an oath to the effect that he had been alone. In the same way, you carefully avoided looking at where your body was in plain view. Instead, you looked around the perimeter of the circle. You looked around the temple, avoiding the one spot that you thought you wanted to see. It really made me think. I had heard something like that before. I had once seen an old monk who had had a bad attack of migraine. As he had explained it to me afterwards, things at which he looked were not there. If he looked at a thing in front of him, he could only see things at the side, but if he looked towards the side, he could see things in front of him. He told me it was like looking through a pair of tubes placed over his eyes, so that in effect he was as one wearing blinkers. Alana, I did not know one from the other then, said, the obvious often might be invisible because the more common an object, the more familiar an object, the less noticeable it becomes. Take the man who brings barley, you see him every day, and yet you do not see him. He is such a familiar figure that had I asked you who came along here this morning you would say, no one, because you would not regard the barley carrier as a person but just as something that always did a certain thing at a specified time. It seemed most remarkable to me that I should be lying on the ground, but then be unable to see my own body. However, I had heard so much about hypnotism and astral traveling that I was quite able to accept their explanation. The old, wizened lama smiled at me as he remarked, we shall soon have to give you more specific instructions so that you can leave your body easily at any time. Like everyone else, you have been doing astral traveling every night, traveling off to distant places and then forgetting about it. But we want to show you how easy it is for you to get out of your body at any time at all, and go on an astral journey, and then return to your body retaining the full knowledge of all that you have seen, all that you have done. If you can do that you can travel to the great cities of the world and you will not be isolated here in Tibet but can acquire a knowledge of all cultures. I thought about that. I had wondered often how some of our higher lamas seem to have all knowledge. They seem to be beings apart, being remote from the pettiness of everyday life, being able to say what was happening at any moment in any part of our country. I remembered on one occasion I with my guide had called upon an old man. I had been presented to him, and we had been talking, or rather my guide and he had been talking and I had been respectfully listening. Suddenly the old man had held up his hand, saying, I am called. Then he had withdrawn, the light seemed to go out from his body. He sat there immobile, looking like a man dead, looking like an empty shell. My guide sat quite still, and motioned for me also to be still and quiet. We sat together with our hands clasped in our laps, we sat without speaking, without moving. I watched what appeared to be the empty figure with vast interest, for perhaps 10, perhaps 20 minutes. It was difficult to gauge time under those circumstances, nothing happened. Then there was the color of animation returning to the old man. Eventually he stirred and opened his eyes, and then, I shall never forget it. He told my guide exactly what was happening at Shigatse, which was quite some way from us. It occurred to me that this was far better as a system of communication than all the remarkable devices I had heard of in the outside world. I wanted to be able to astral travel anywhere. I wanted to be able to move across the mountains, and across the seas and into foreign lands. And these men, these 9 lamas were going to teach me. The old cat yawned, making his whiskers vibrate, and then he stood up and stretched until I almost thought he would break in two. Then he strolled off, arrogantly pushing his way between 2 lamas, and disappeared into the darkness behind one of the sacred figures. The old, wizened lama spoke, saying, well, it is time we brought this session to an end, for we did not come here to teach Lobsang on this occasion, this is just an incidental. We must set about our other work, and we will see Lobsang again when his guide returns. Another one turned to me and gave me a hard stare. You will have to learn very carefully, Lobsang. You have a lot to do in life, you will have hardships, suffering, you will travel far and often. But in the end you will achieve that which is your task. We will give you the basic training. They rose to their feet, picked up the crystal leaving the stand, and left the temple. I sat wondering. A task. Hardship? But I had always been told I had a hard life ahead of me, always been told I had a task, so why did they rub it in so? Anyhow, why did I have to do the task, why was I always the one to have suffering? The more I heard about it the less I liked it. But I did want to travel in the astral and see all the things I had heard about. Gingerly I climbed to my feet, wincing and muttering unkind words as the pains shot through my legs again. Pins and needles, and then a few bumps and bruises where I had fallen down a few times, and a pain between my shoulder blades where I had been resting upon my bowl. Thinking of that, I reached inside my robe and sorted my possessions into their accustomed position. Then, with a final look round, I left the temple. At the door I hastily turned and went back to the flickering butter lamps. One by one I snuffed them out, for that was my duty. I was the last one to leave, therefore I was the one to snuff out the lamps. As I felt my way through the darkness to where there was a faint glimmer from the open door, my nostrils were assailed by the stench of smoldering wicks. Somewhere off in a corner there was the dying red ember of a wick which was just then charring into blackness. I stood for a moment at the door deciding which way I would go. Then, with my mind made up, I turned and made my way to the right. The bright starlight was pouring in through the windows, imparting a silvery blue appearance to everything. I turned a corner in the corridor and stopped suddenly, thinking, yes, of course they were right. I stood there a moment and thought. It occurred to me that time after time I had passed an old monk sitting in a little cell, and yet although I saw him every day I had never even noticed him. I retraced my steps for perhaps 10 yards, and peered in. There he was in a little stone cell on the far side of the corridor opposite the windows. He was blind. Endlessly he sat there on the floor turning a prayer wheel, rather a big one, it was, turning, turning, turning. Whenever anyone passed by there was the eternal click, 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 of the old monk's prayer wheel. Hour after hour, day after day he sat there, believing that it was his allotted task in life to keep that prayer wheel turning. And that was all he lived for. We who passed that way so often were immune to the turning of the wheel. We were so accustomed to it that we neither saw the old monk, nor heard his wheel a click. I stood there in the dark doorway and pondered as the wheel clicked on, and as the old man softly droned, Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. His voice was hoarse, and his fingers were twisted and gnarled. I could make him out but dimly, and he was quite oblivious of me, turning the wheel, as he had turned the wheel for so many years, turning it long before I was born. How much longer will he turn it? I wondered. But it pointed out to me that people were invisible if they were so familiar that one did not have to notice them. It occurred to me, too, that sounds were silences if one became too accustomed to them. I thought of the times when I had been quite alone in a dark cell, and then after a time I would hear the gurgle and rustle of body sounds, the blood surging through the veins and arteries of the body, and then I would hear the steady thud, thud, thud of my heart pumping away. After a time, too, I could actually hear the air sighing through my lungs, and when I moved the slight creak and snap of muscles pulling bones to a different position. We all have that. We are all noisy contraptions, I thought, and yet when there are other sounds which attract our attention we just do not hear those with which we are constantly surrounded and which do not obtrude. I stood on one leg, and scratched my head. Then I thought the night was already far advanced, soon there would come the call to temple service at midnight. So I hesitated no more but put both feet on the ground, pulled my robe more tightly around me, and moved off up the corridor to the dormitory. As soon as I lay down I fell asleep. Sleep was not long my companion. I twisted and turned, creaked and groaned as I lay and thought of life as it was. In a lamasery. About me boys wheezed and muttered in their sleep, the sound of their snores rising and falling on the night air. One boy who suffered from adenoids was making a global global. Global global until in desperation I rose and turned him on his side. I lay on my back, thinking, listening. From somewhere came the monotonous click click of a prayer wheel as some monk endlessly twirled it so that his prayers could go winging forth. From afar came the muted clop clop as someone rode a horse up the path outside our window. The night dragged on. Time stood still. Life was an eternity of waiting, waiting, where nothing moved. Where all was still save for the snores, the click of the prayer wheel and the muffled steps of the horse. I must have dozed. Wearily I sat up. The floor was hard and unyielding. The cold of the stone was creeping into my bones. Somewhere a boy muttered that he wanted his mother. Stiffly I climbed to my feet and moved to the window, carefully avoiding the sleeping bodies around me. The cold was intense and there was a threat of snow to come. Over the vast Himalayan ranges the morning was sending forth tendrils of light, colored fingers seeking our valley, waiting to light up yet another day. The spume of snow dust always flying from the very highest peaks was illumined now by golden light shining on its underside, while from the top came scintillating rainbow crescents which wavered and blossomed to the vagaries of the high winds. Across the sky shot vivid beams of light as the sun peeped through the mountain passes and gave a promise of another day soon to be. The stars faded. No longer was the sky a purple vault, it lightened, lightened, and became the palest blue. The whole of the mountains were limned with gold as the sky grew brighter. Gradually the blinding orb of the sun climbed above the mountain passes and shone forth in blazing glory into our valley. The cold was intense. Ice crystals fell from the sky and cracked on the roof with a musical tinkle. There was a bitterness, a sharpness in the air that almost froze the marrow in one's bones. What a peculiar climate, I thought, sometimes too cold to snow, and yet, sometimes at midday it would be uncomfortably hot. Then, in the twinkling of an eye, a great windstorm would rise and send all flying before it. Always, in the mountains, there was snow, deep snow, but on the exposed stretches the winds blew away the snow as fast as it fell. Our country was high, and with rarefied air. Air so thin and clear that it afforded scant shelter from the ultraviolet, or heat-generating, rays of the sun. In our summer a monk could swelter miserably in his robes, then, as a cloud momentarily obscured the sun, the temperature would fall to many degrees below freezing, all in a few minutes. We suffered greatly from windstorms. The Great Barrier of the Himalayas sometimes held back clouds that formed over India, causing a temperature inversion. Then howling gales would pour over the mountain lips and storm down into our valley, sweeping all before it. People who wandered abroad during the storms had to wear leather face masks or risk having the skin stripped from them by the rock dust torrenting down, windborne, from the highest reaches. Travelers caught in the open on the mountain passes would risk being blown away, unless they were alert and quick to act, their tents and other possessions would be blown in the air, whirling ragged and ruined, playthings of the mindless wind. Somewhere below, in the pale morning, a yak bellowed mournfully. As if at the signal, the trumpets blared forth from the roof high above. The conches lowed and throbbed, to echo and re-echo and fuse into a medley of sound like some multiple chord played on a mighty organ. About me there were all the myriad sounds of a large community awakening to a new day, to another day of life. A chant from the temple, the neighing of horses, muttered grumbles from sleepy small boys shivering naked in the intensely cold air. And as a muted undertone, the incessant clicking of the prayer wheels located through the buildings, turned and turned eternally by old, old monks who thought that it was their sole purpose in life. The place was astir. Activity increased from moment to moment. Shaven heads peered hopefully from open windows, wishing for a warmer day. A dark blob, shapeless, formless, wobbled from somewhere above and crossed my line of vision to crash with a sharp crack on the rocks below. Someone's bull, I thought, now he will have to go without breakfast until he can obtain another. Breakfast? Of course. We have started another day, a day when I would need to have my strength up because I was hoping that my beloved guide would be returning this day, and before I could see him there were morning classes, temple service, but before all, breakfast. Tsampa is unappetizing stuff, but it was all I knew about except for very rare, very infrequent delicacies from India. So I trudged off down the corridor, following the line of boys and monks wending their way down to the hall where we ate. At the entrance I hung about a bit, waiting for some of the others to settle down because I was shaky on my legs, somewhat uncertain in my steps, and when everyone was milling about it posed a definite threat to my stability. Eventually I walked in and took my place among the lines of men and boys sitting on the floor. We sat cross-legged, all except me, and I sat with my legs tucked under me. There were lines of us, perhaps 250 of us at one time. As we sat there monk attendants came and ladled out tsampa, passing along the rows, giving each of us our fair equitable share. Monks stood at the sides of each row, and then at a given signal they all went between our ranks with our food. No one could eat, though, until the attending master gave the signal. At last each monk and boy had his bowl full of sampa. The attendants stood at the side,